In November 2008, shortly after Barack Hussein Obama was elected president, a reporter, a commentator on CNN asked Benjamin Jealous, who is the president of the NAACP, whether Obama's election signaled an end to the need of such organizations as the NAACP, Southern Leadership Council, Urban League, and such the like. And Mr. Jealous replied that his organization's name is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, not a colored person. This answer stuck with me as I've listened to public discourse and participated in listservs and Facebook conversations in the intervening months. This question or comment, or these questions akin to it, seeps into our dialogue. We have a black president. Doesn't that prove that racism is over, that we're in a post-racial age? The use of the word post with which to refer to any shift in thinking may in itself be a part of the problem. Post-colonial, post-Christian, post-racial, and so it goes. Such use of this word post signifies that whatever age was has passed. There's a new dawning of a new and by inference better age. Discourse about systemic entrenched isms become difficult in the public domain. What I'm trying to say is when you change the language about it, then it also shifts our ability to talk about it. We already have a hard time talking about race and gender and heterosexism and any other ism, ageism that you can think of. And then you do the doublespeak, and that makes it even harder. The chant that was started by college students, "Race doesn't matter," during the campaign season, further served to obscure the very real, virulent, if submerged, interlocking oppressive systems that I just mentioned. Racism, sexism, classism, ageism, heterosexism, add your own ism to it. For the brief time that we are here together, I want to address the role proponents of womanist thought see themselves playing in making it plain the issues that continue to plague our social order, and try to suggest how finding voice in the midst of what is called guerrilla enemy is the ongoing task of womanist work. Mostly I'm going to tell you stories, because storytelling is a primary womanist tool. Uncovering what is behind what is often called objective thinking, which, of course, in womanist thought and other ideological kinds of way of looking at the world, is a farce. There is no such thing as objective. There's only those things that have been accepted as the way it is. It is not considered scholarly enough, and I do put that in quotes, by some, or rigorous enough by others, but as womanist ethicist, Emily Towns, a renowned theologian and the distinguished Andrew Mellon Professor of African American Religion and Theology at Yale Divinity School, she's also the dean we mine our particular context, for they are rich with the nutrients for change. So story, both biographical and autobiographical, historical, become the sites of inquiry for womanist thought. I should pause here and explain this term, womanist. Alice Walker, as it is currently used, first coined the term womanist in her collection of essays, In Search of Our Mother's Garden. And she, in that essay, I'll explain the story. She's telling a story as a woman who's a feminist of how she's working with feminists who cannot see that they don't deal with racism. And so she says womanist is to feminist as purple is to lavender. It is a necessity to dig deeper, go farther, to mine a mother lode. How, since 1983, has womanist come to be defined within the academy? From the first appearance of that word, African American women, mostly literary critics, embrace the term. And then they begin to develop methodologies for reading and interpreting writings, especially works by North American writers, and again, especially the works of women of color. Having done that as literary critics, African-American women Christian theologians and ethicists also found the term compelling, and a crop of writings by these scholars using what they call womanist strategies began to appear. The chief goal and appropriation of the term, according to these scholars, is to prioritize issues facing poor African-American women and, by extension, women of color everywhere. So Emily Towns describes womanist this way. Perhaps the most common understanding of womanist is that she is a woman committed to an integrated analysis of race, gender, and class. Other things have been added to that, including heterosexism and survival tactics. I'll say more about that. This analysis arises from a deep concern to address the shortcomings of traditional feminist and Black theological modes of discourse. The former feminist has a long legacy of ignoring race and class issues. The latter had disregarded gender and class. Both modes of discourse have begun to address these internal flaws. Yet, womanist reflection maintains its critical perspective of feminist and African-American traditional ways of analytical reflection. In other words, womanist thought was born out of, I call them, the step-parents of feminist thought and Black theology. Both step-parents, because of what was missing in those modes of thinking. I'll say more about that. This critical perspective, Towns still speaking, extends to Eurocentric discourse as well. Much of what womanist thought seeks to debunk is the notion of universals and absolutes. Womanist thought is intentionally and unapologetically biased for a diverse and faithful community of witnesses. These witnesses are an active force for love and justice in the midst of oppression and fallenness. The end of her quote. New Testament scholar, a man, Asiende Aubrey Hendricks, says that the root experiences of one's life informs and directs one's vocation, writing, and reflects on what he calls colored commentaries. The whole point of the autobiographical critical reflection based in womanist sensibilities is to create an opening for these kinds of commentaries. It is to be very self-conscious of what is driving you, your history, your experiences, all of that. Hendricks describes this as guerrilla exegete in his work this way. She or he, the guerrilla exegete, she, the freedom fighter, she or he, the counter-hegemonic karate woe man, is not a prize fighter sweating in his or her draws for the hegemonic pat on the head. No, she or he struggles because her or his people are biblocentric, their lives devotedly focused on a Bible whose liberatory powers have been diffused and confused by dominant interpreters. She or he struggles for the lives of those lovingly dedicated to a Bible whose strategically imposed hegemonic readings militate against their own fragile well-being. She struggles because the Bible continues to stand as the foremost tool of oppression and hegemonic domination in human history, surpassing even the Communist Manifesto for the mayhem committed in its name. The end of his quote. I didn't say that. That was Asiende. Of course, I'm quoting him, so that may mean I kind of agree with him. Just as with guerrilla exegesis, womanist work is a consciousness, remembering with whom and for whom the scholar searches the text and searches history and ethics and all of that. That is to say that this work has someone in mind. It is not disembodied. It is not dislocated in an ivory tower. It is working with and for people literally in the dirt. So theology, retrieving history, ethics, it's self-consciousness and community-minded. By definition, the womanist thought is counterintelligence work and is guerrilla warfare itself. Given our militaristic worldview, I hesitate to use warfare metaphor, except to know that it is prevalent in the Hebrew text. But if womanist work is anything, it is the undermining of the status quo, a questioning of all the things that we just know. Starting my dissertation on Micah, for example, was my own attempt at engaging in this kind of sabotage. One of the challenges for womanist thinkers is that the academy still presumes a certain style of discourse, and I put that in quotation marks, despite its protest to the contrary. The presumption is pervasive and passed on to master's level students who reflect their acceptance of this patriarchal, white privileged style as real scholarship, and therefore scholarship by people of color, by muristas, by womanist scholars is cute and it's exotic, but it's not real. Thus, womanist professors often will hear students in universities and seminaries throughout this country and beyond ask questions like, when are we going to get to what we're supposed to be learning? When will we read the real scholars? The womanist pedagogue spends time in the generative work of womanist scholarship in any other interested scholarship, as if all scholarship is not interested or ideological. You know, the difference is that the interest of the empire / patriarch or the privilege and other dominant voices is so inculcated into the domain that it just seems natural and obvious rather than what it is, learned. Tendeka, a feminist womanist theologian who wrote Learning to Be White, Money, Race, and God in America, she teaches at Mead Lombard, and as a Universalist Unitarian minister as well. She was also an Emmy Award-winning producer for 16 years, so that may say something about her engagement with culture. She demonstrates this notion of nothing is natural when she does a workshop and she asks white participants to spend the day referring to their white friends as my white friend, Jonathan. And she talks about how uncomfortable that is, whereas no white person has a problem saying my Latina friend, Ed, or my black friend, Valerie. But if you ask them to say my white friend, Julia, the white is so blinding in our culture that we don't even know that we have literally whitewashed the world. So one way this domination is reflected, even in the way academic and public discourse insist that feminist and womanist scholars choose language that everybody will be comfortable with. It's reflected in this subtitle of a recent book by Cheryl B. Anderson, who is one of my Hebrew Bible colleagues, Ancient Laws and Contemporary Controversies. Rather than use the word womanist, assumed inaccessible to the masses, the publishers insisted, and she acquiesced to the subtitle, The Need for Inclusive Biblical Interpretation. Another womanist scholar, Will Gaffney, has chosen the term rad femme / womanist in order to stay in the larger feminist discourse and not be, in the terms of one of her white feminist friends, ghettoized. When working on my own essay, It Ain't Necessarily So, Womanist Thought and Resisting Preaching, there was an editor present at the SBL when I made the presentation, and he walked up to me afterwards, gave me his card. He said, I'm deeply intrigued. I think this is a book. I really want to talk to you about it. We talked several times. Anybody who's a scholar knows this process. We talked. Now, He said, so much so that I really can see this. And I'm like every other scholar. It's called publish or perish, P-A-R-I-S-H, or perish. P-E-R-I-S-H. And so we keep publishing for these reasons, right? So then he said, but I want you to use the word inclusive instead of womanist, because nobody will know what that word is, and they won't buy it if that word is on it. When I pressed him as to why he thought that was, he maintained that it was too narrow, even though womanist thought is committed to the work of the whole people, loving the whole people. Mind you, he had just admitted to me that this very thought, womanist thought, had helped him re-examine and rethink the role of resisting the text that demean and that ought to be engaged more critically than we usually do. He had just gotten fascinated by my constant use of the word womanist. But when enthralled by the possibility of getting it out in the public, he did not once say, we need to educate the public. We need to help them learn this discourse. We need to put you on a tour so that you can become an expert in womanist thought. We need to make this word as commonplace as the word inclusive. No, he suggested that I give up the categories, the taxonomy, and the community that helps to shape my thinking, my activism, my scholarship, and my relationships. Now, there are those who that his sincerity just natural. Speak the language that people know. But no biblical scholar expects that students should not learn the phrase sitz im Leben or zeitgeist. Womanist scholars continue to refuse or resist this further marginalization. However, and founding womanist religious scholar Katie Cannon has gathered a group of scholars who self-identify as womanists and who are producing a volume 25 years after this term has come into the academy. And I'm looking forward to that volume. It should be out this year. It's all the big name womanist scholars. Now, what is this to do with the so-called post-racial world? Well, I think it has a lot to do. All you're going to do is watch viral videos, blogs, TV commentaries, news reports, the number of threats on the president's life, which he had, think about this, Barack Hussein Obama had had more threats on his life before he was elected president than all the presidents combined since they have been keeping records. And most of those threats were laced with racist, hateful language for him and his family. Do you really think we're in a post-racist world? It tells me that the work of womanist scholars is not only vital, but necessary. Necessary. That black women's concerns about violence against the whole folk and not just women and not just people of color, that racism and classism often marry one another, that Seeley statement in The Color Purple, that is, if God ever cared about poor black women, the world would be a whole lot better place, is the paradigm and the mandate of our work. And it pushed her and those of us who claim the moniker to name ourselves and our realities. We are still, womanists, are still living in the paradox described by Patricia Hill Collins. All the women are white, all the men are black, but some of us are brave. Womanists could not be forced back into the background of black power and liberation movements, where they said things like white women are using you to emasculate black men, or in the background of feminist movements, where they said things like you got to choose whether you're going to be black or a woman. As if to be black and female and an activist, social activist, was a combination that was too much for the liberation movements. Meaning, then, is in the interstices of the multiple challenges that face the least among us. And historically, as Janetta Coleman pointed out, that's a poor black woman when she claimed Jesus is a sister. And by saying so, meaning that Jesus identifies with the least among us. Finally, a word about voice in our times. The work of womanist activist scholars is to resist the double speak of our times and rightly name the challenges that lay before us. Dorothy Height, one of the founding sisters of the NAACP, recently in D.C., noted that young people are walking through doors that they are not aware of about how they became open. No one expects that the present and the future to be so tethered to the past that society is immobilized. But womanist work is to refuse to slap a bandage on the ooze of the ick, that's a theological word, by the way, that infects this society and the world by using phrases like post-racial. My granddaughter, the daughter of a German mother and a mutt of a father, her father's African-American Cherokee with papers, English. You know, every black person is a Cherokee, but we actually have papers in our family. y'all know I'm telling the truth. No. Oh, I had a tribal leader say to me, don't file those papers. There's no money left. Okay. Knows herself by her heritage, but my granddaughter's mother also is deeply aware that in our context, race matters, gender matters, her social location matters. The woman's work I do still seeks to uncover the wealth and riches that people of color, women, people made poor, and other marginalized people offer to the world, even if they don't know they need it, even if the world doesn't know they need to hear from these people. We have work to do, and the first order of business is to stop pretending as if we don't. Thank you.